Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here again today. We are in Acts chapter 23. We'll beginning in verse 12, right after we do a brief introduction with some of the details. You've got pages 3 and 4 of the notes. They're kind of like the leftovers or a little bit of addition from last week's notes. So pages 1 and 2 are from last week. The page you got today are pages 3 and 4 expanded a little bit. But what has taken place, as you know, Paul's gone to Jerusalem. He's been convinced by the church the best thing for him to do is to go up to the Temple Mount and show that he's not against the law. And Paul's not against, you know, following and worshiping on the temple. Obviously, otherwise he would not have done it. His policy is not burn the temple and abandon the Jewish law. His point is salvation is found by faith in Jesus Christ. If you want to worship Jesus Christ on the Temple Mount, you certainly can do it. James apparently continued to do that throughout his life. And other Christians are going to the Temple Mount if they're Jews. There's a problem with trying to convince the Gentiles that they should go to the Temple Mount, Jewish culture. Paul even is going to stand before the Sanhedrin and say again that he is a Pharisee. He's not going to say, I was a Pharisee and I've abandoned it. Paul, in his mind, can continue to hold to the doctrines of the Pharisees, which would include the inspiration of Scripture, the existence of an afterlife, the existence of angels, a variety of Pharisee doctrines, except he would then abandon the works of the law for salvation, and that's where they would separate. There are many Pharisees that have joined the Christian ranks. That's probably causing some of the problems because they want the Gentiles to come in. Again, it's hard to drop off that Pharisee training. Paul has, as far as being stringent for the law for salvation. Or right standing with God. Right standing with God, Paul says, is faith in Jesus Christ, or our right standing with God is in Christ, not in our own obedience. But yet you don't have to abandon the doctrines of the Pharisees, and the Pharisees had many doctrines that Paul still agrees to, including, as we saw last week, the resurrection from the dead. The Pharisees are all about the resurrection from the dead, or a possibility that an angel or some spirit appeared to Paul and spoke to him. The Sadducees now on the other side, they're also Jews. They do not believe in resurrection. They don't believe in spirits or angels. And they only accept the first five books of the Bible, the Torah, as scripture. As far as David's writings, Samuel, the prophets, that's all additional writings the way we might view the Apocrypha or something else that's not scripture. That's how they viewed the rest of the scriptures, including Daniel and some great prophecies there. So you can imagine the division in the Jewish culture. If you do not accept all the writings from Samuel, Judges, all the way up until Nehemiah, you reject those as being authoritative, but you're dealing with others like the Pharisees or other Jews that accept it as scripture. Now the priests come in, and the priests are most likely Sadducees. And what you're going to see the priests and the Sadducees doing is siding most often with the Romans, the Pharisees siding with the conservatives, the patriots, the Pharisees are siding with the rebels in many cases, where the priests are siding with Rome, because that's where the power's at. So you just feel that tension, and we don't want to forget that tension here in 57 A.D., because that's where Paul's at. Paul's in 57 A.D., and by 66 A.D., the Jewish wars are going to break out, and that's going to result in civil war within Jerusalem of these different factions fighting against each other in Jerusalem, while they're being attacked by Rome on the outside, or Rome is sweeping through, coming down through Jerusalem, coming down through Israel or through Judea to come to Jerusalem. So in 57 AD, there is a hotbed amongst the Jews. You can see it in the Sanhedrin last week when Paul says, I'm here because I believe in the resurrection of the dead. And the Sanhedrin, it wasn't the Romans and the Jews blew up, the Jews blew up. Their Senate, their consul, their leading group of people, including the high priest, they became so violent that the Romans had to come into their meeting and drag Paul out to save him, not from the mob on the Temple Mount, but from, you know, a Senate hearing, basically. He's like a televised Senate hearing, and Paul's being attacked by Jews, and the Romans are saving Paul because he is a Roman citizen. Again, you've got the Romans coming to Paul's rescue, saving him from the Jews, because they respect him more as a Roman citizen than the Jews respect him as a rabbi or as a Jew. So, I mean, this is just a boiling pot of confusion. And this is 57 A.D., and within 9 years, the Jewish wars are going to be breaking out. And this high priest that we're seeing here, Ananias, that we saw last week, he's going to Josephus refers to him as being, I've got the notes there, if you want to pick this up on the top of page 3. Ananias, some details about him that we've mentioned last week already. But he's going to rule for 12 years. He is appointed as high priest in 47 AD. So he's been high priest for about 10 years. Josephus records him as being a very selfish man as far as taking on the wealth for himself. There's a time where he goes down to the threshing floor where people are coming in. It's like bringing your cattle to market. They're bringing their grain to the threshing floor, and they're supposed to pay a tithe off of it or a tax, but he goes down and sends his servants down to just take the tithe. I mean, not wait for them to pay the taxes or pay the tithe at the temple. He goes down and just takes it, and if they don't pay it, the workers are beaten, and that was actually supposed to be a tithe that goes to the priest, not to the high priest himself personally, but he takes it. And Josephus records there, because of that, many elderly priests that were waiting for this tithe to come in or the tax money to come in, they starved to death. And so the Jews don't like Ananias, the high priest here, that's ruling during this time. Last week we saw Paul mouth off to him and then apologize. Why did he, you know, call him? He says two things. He calls him a whitewashed wall, which was right out of Ezekiel, which is referring to the fact that he is, or the priesthood, or at least the individual, is unstable, shaky, breaking down, not, you know, fortified, but is covered up with some kind of plaster, some kind of white paint to make it look good. He appears solid, but Paul says he's not. That's how Ezekiel attacked the whole nation and the leadership back in, you know, 500 AD or BC. Then he says, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. And when he says God will strike, that, again, Paul apologizes for mouthing off the high priest. He says, I did not know you were the high priest. And the variety of reasons, we talked about that. Probably the best one is that Paul had been absent from Jerusalem for about 20 years and hadn't been, or longer, and hadn't really come in contact with this priest and didn't recognize him. If they're sitting in a Sanhedrin and everyone's dressed up, does the high priest not have his garments on? He might just look like one of the members of the Sanhedrin and orders that Paul be struck, and Paul mouths off to him and says, well, God will strike you. And the thing is, that was prophetic, because within 9 years, when Rome is sweeping down towards Jerusalem, and Ananias is going to go hide with his brother because he sides with the Romans, and now the Jews are revolting in the city and they're taking out all the Roman supporters, sympathizers, and the priesthood has to go hide. And Ananias is hiding in an aqueduct with his brother Hezekiah. Josephus records this. And the Jewish rebels find him and beat him to death because he's a Roman sympathizer. And the rebels, the Pharisees, the conservatives, the patriots, have taken over the city and are punishing the priest. Again, that story can develop more and more. But anyway, God did strike within 9 years. He was proven to be nothing but a whitewashed wall. And God did strike him down. He slapped Paul. And then through the events in history, this priest ends up getting beaten to death by the rebels in 66 AD. It goes on, talks more about this. What else we got here? Okay, we ended last week with chapter 23, verse 11. And Paul was then rescued from the Sanhedrin. We can read this here. Verse 6, then Paul, knowing that some were Sadducees and the others Pharisees, called out in the Sanhedrin, my brothers, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Now, son of a Pharisee means the son of my father's the Pharisee, meaning that would refer to not just his dad's a Pharisee, but his father's are Pharisees. So at least extending back to his dad and his grandfather were Pharisees, meaning he comes from a family of Pharisees, which makes more and more sense why he's at a young age being sent to Jerusalem into some kind of boarding school to be trained. I can never imagine that, sending my kids to a boarding school far away and ever only seeing them on vacations, you know. Well, sometimes we could imagine that. It's like, it doesn't sound like a bad idea certain times. But, you know, but that's what they did for Paul. They didn't raise him. They had him as a child. Once he was able to, you know, get some kind of training, they sent him away. And that's going to come up, too, when we find out his nephew's in town. Paul's nephew, that's going to come up. We just left it off for last week. Paul's nephew, the son of his sister, is in Jerusalem. Now, why is he there? Do they live there? Or has he been sent there for training also? We don't know the answer to these questions. But either one of those could be possible. But he says, I'm the son of Pharisees, and I stand on trial because of my hope in the resurrection of the dead. Now notice that right there. The hope of the resurrection of the dead is not being claimed here as a Christian doctrine. He's not claiming this as the resurrection of Jesus Christ here. He's saying, as a Pharisee, I believe it is possible for a man to be raised from the dead. In fact, their doctrine is they will all be raised from the dead, according to Daniel's words, that we'll all be resurrected in the end. And so he's talking Pharisee doctrine. Notice how Paul, if he's talking in Athens, he talks in the Greek language. If he's in Corinth, he's not afraid to go into the rhetoric of the philosophers. If he's in a synagogue, he's not afraid to go through the Old Testament scriptures and prove that the Messiah must suffer. Well, now he's in front of the Sanhedrin and says, hey, basically this comes down to one issue, is do we believe in the resurrection of the dead or not? And the Pharisees say, well, absolutely. That's one of the first things we cover in synagogue or in Pharisee school. And the Sadducees, absolutely not. That's the first thing we discredit in Sadducee school. And so he splits them. Now, again, obviously he's working out. Now, again, what's interesting is why is he on trial? Because of the riot that he was accused of bringing a Gentile into the temple courts of the Jews, which he didn't do. Now, Lysicus, the commander, he wants to find out. He could never find out what the Jews were so upset about. So he's trying to find out what are they accusing Paul of. He knows it's something to do with the law. So Paul's actually there because the Jews started a revolt because he apparently violated the temple courts. In fact, they shut it down. But he's actually there preaching Christ to the Jews, hopefully. But the trial here is he's switching it to, the issue he's switching it to is the resurrection from the dead. So you've got the riot on the Temple Mount, but now Paul's got the Sanhedrin trying to talk about an issue that they're never going to resolve because some believe and some don't. But actually, he's there to promote Jesus Christ. And so what is Paul on trial for here? The Romans don't know. They're trying to find out. Paul's making the issue the resurrection from the dead, which half of the group is going to agree with. But really, he's there as a Christian, and the church is afraid of Paul, because the Jerusalem church, because they're trying to reach people who are trying to follow the law, and the word is that Paul doesn't follow the law. So once again, there's a whole bunch of confusion going on here, and Paul, in a sense, is not helping it here, because he can't just jump in and say, I believe in Jesus Christ, because the issue of Jesus Christ goes way back to he was resurrected from the dead, that he was sent by God, that he's a Messiah from the Old Testament. There's many things that Paul's going to build on this if he has the chance, but of course he doesn't. Verse 7, when he said this, a dispute broke out between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly, or the Sanhedrin, was divided. The Sadducees say that there is no resurrection and that there are neither angels nor spirits, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. Now again, when it says they do not believe in angels or spirits, and yet they believe in the first five books of the Bible as scripture, right in the Garden of Eden, there's an angel guarding the tree. I mean, you've got angels appearing to Abraham. You've got angels coming and going throughout those first five books. There's angels, cherubim, on the Ark of the Covenant. So that's I'm not saying Luke's making a mistake there, but he may have more of an intention of saying, at this time in the Jewish culture, there's developing layers and hierarchies of spiritual beings, kind of like the Gnostics, where you go through these different ranks of angelic beings, and they may reject that whole teaching as far as there's not ranks of angels that we access God through. It might be something more general like that, because it's kind of hard to understand that they flat out don't believe in spirit beings when, again, those first five books of the Bible do have angelic creatures. But nonetheless, the Pharisees obviously believe in the activities of spiritual beings. There was a great uproar, and some of the teachers of the law who were Pharisees stood up and argued vigorously. They're going to argue for Paul now. Paul's now getting his defense not from himself, but from half of the Sanhedrin. We find nothing wrong with this man, they said. What if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him? Now, what they're referring to is that on the road to Damascus, a spirit appeared, a voice spoke to him. I know we know it as Jesus Christ, the man from Nazareth who's now the resurrected Lord. They say they're going to just push it off as, well, maybe a spirit or voice did appear to him. The dispute became so violent, that's an interesting word, not just an aggressive dispute, but violent, physically aggressive, that the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them. So now he's watching to see if he can find out what the charges are. Now he's even more confused. that Paul would be torn to pieces, he ordered the troops to go down, these are Roman soldiers, and take him away from them by force and bring them back to the barracks. Now, in Jerusalem, and we just so we get a picture of this also, I should have put some kind of map up there or something, but we know the temple court, here's the western wall, the temple mount is like this, here's the temple, here's Fort Antonia up here on this spot right here, here's the western wall, here's the plaza today. Right about here, there's the Hall of the Hewn Stone, is what Josephus records. They found, in fact, I've seen a huge mikveh as we go down to these Western Wall tunnels. It was just recently excavated, and they're doing more and more excavation here, finding stuff that I haven't even seen because the last time we were there was 2012, and things have developed since then. But right in here is where the Sanhedrin met. Josephus records that. It's basically a fourth of a mile right here. We got 400 yards, 400 meters from Fort Antonia to this Sanhedrin meeting, the Hall of the Hewn Stone. And this is where they would meet. And so this is where the troops brought him to, and they're going to have to bring him back. Now, that's important for what's coming up in our story, is where this is located. And they bring him back to Fort Antonia. Now, Paul is not in prison. He's under custody, because right here on the temple courts, a riot broke out, and the mob was ripping him to pieces, and the troops went down and rescued him from the Jewish people, took him up here because they thought he was a terrorist. Now they find out he's a Roman citizen. Well, what are the charges? So now he's basically under the protection, not so much in prison as much as under the protection of the Romans, from the mob first. Now they take him to the Sanhedrin and say, we just want to know what the charges are with this man. He's a Roman citizen. Why do you want him charged? And when he gets there, it's like they go, that just blew up, so they got to rescue him from the Sanhedrin. Now he is again under Roman protection, not just from the mob, but from the Sanhedrin, and the Romans are still going, what is going on here? So they're hoping to find something out. So here we go. Now he's back under Rome. Again, remember, he's under Rome. He's not free, but he's being held to find out, are the charges serious enough that we need to follow up on them or dismiss them? But either way, we've got to protect Paul until we hear the case. Again, there's some good things about Roman law. I'll say this. I'll say this. Because I've been doing some reading through the Byzantine time periods and stuff on eschatology. Now, this is way off subject, but it does deal with Rome. I don't want you to accept this. I don't want you to, but I want you to know it at least. Because remember that verse? Because it fits so well with our culture today. Here we go. Political. You know that it says, when he is taken out of the way, then the man of lawlessness will be revealed. You know that verse? And nobody, including me, knows who he is. Now, when I was pre-trib, he was the spirit in the presence of the church. And once the church is gone, all hell breaks loose. The tribulation of the 70th week. Okay, that's possible. I'm not discrediting that, but I discredit pre-trib now. But maybe it's the spirit in the church. Maybe it's the spirit is gone. A lot of people, especially those left behind series, not left behind, but, you know, the Distant Thunder, remember those movies? That if you are gone, if you miss the rapture, then you're in the tribulation. The Spirit of God was gone. You couldn't get saved and stuff like that sometimes. Sometimes people taught that. So he could be the church. It doesn't make sense because it should be a she, everyone would say. He could be the Spirit in the presence of the church, because the Spirit can't be gone during the 70th week because it's still there. He's still there. Some would say it's an angel. Like, there's an angel, and we see all the way through Revelation, certain angels holding back the waters or holding back the winds or holding, you know, protecting the way of the Euphrates, whatever. So it could be an angel that's been in charge of this. Now, I'm not telling you this is what I'm teaching. This is something I've just seen. Maybe you've already seen it. But in the first 200-300 years of church history, the Roman Empire was pagan, being inundated with Christianity continuing to grow. It persecuted Christianity, sometimes blamed Christianity, but eventually Christianity became legal. In fact, the emperor becomes Christian and converts the whole empire. Constantine converts the whole empire, gives the church government property, supports the church, supports the priest, almost more of a disaster than the persecuted church. I mean, you want to be in a government-sponsored church or a persecuted church? Well, as an employee, I'd like to be in the government-sponsored church, but as a true believer, you really want to be in the persecuted church. You understand what I'm saying? Neither one's really that good. But anyway, It then becomes, at that time, it's no longer, it's still called the Roman Empire, but it's known in history then as the Byzantine Empire, because Constantine moves from Rome to Constantinople or Byzantium. You're with me on this? It just switches to the Byzantine Empire. Now, for many years, I didn't know what the Byzantine Empire was until you actually studied, like, oh, it's the Roman Empire in the Christian form. It's just now in a different city. When Islam rises, it fights against the Byzantines. It fights against the West, which was Turkey, okay? I mean, when they were going to go west and conquer the Western world, we're going to conquer the Byzantine Empire, they're talking the Christians in Turkey. It's not like America, Europe, it's in Turkey. And so at that time, the Byzantine Empire, the writers from 325, 400, 600, during early days of Islam, that's what I'm reading right now, something that was written during right after Muhammad's dead, right around 690, the he that they're talking about is the Roman Empire, or the Western world, law and order, the government of the Romans. Now, the plus side of this, you can see right here, Rome trying to protect Paul. Now, if Rome was, and Rome, I'm not defending Rome as being the great, great people or anything, but they did have law and order. You had checks and balances at a certain time. They had some kind of, they were governed by laws. We can trace this from Nebuchadnezzar to Cyrus, from the Babylonians to the Persians, up to the Greeks, up to the Romans. We've done that in that little book I wrote, The Political Platform of the Lord and King, a long time ago. But anyway, you can see them trying to be, they're protecting Paul instead of just saying, forget it, just throw him to the wolves. He's a Roman citizen, we got to take action, because if the commander doesn't take action, he's going to be liable to the law for not protecting the law. Which, isn't that a great idea? We got laws, if you don't protect the law, you violate the law, then you're guilty of violating the law, you don't just make up your own law. Anyway, the teaching at that time was when he, I'm not saying this is right, it's just, it fits, when he is taken out of the way, whoever he is, he, in their case, was when Rome is finally removed, when law and order is completely trampled ground, and God removes the Roman Empire, the Roman policies, the Western style of governing from the earth, then will arise the man of lawlessness. So once law is removed, not the law of Moses, but government, God established government, God established nations, once that foundation is ripped out of the earth and it's allowed to be removed, then coming up out of the earth will be lawlessness and the 70th week, and the man of lawlessness will arise. So, again, when something is going to be removed, and then the man, and that's one of the signs Paul uses. Who is he? Is he the church is removed? Could be. The Spirit of God is removed at some level? Could be. An angel removed? Could be. It just says he is removed. Who? If the Roman government law is removed, or Rome is removed, and then all chaos will break out, it would match that this is law and order. Once law and order is removed, what's going to come? The man of lawlessness. So anyway, that's free today. And you don't have to accept that. It's just something that, kind of another thing to throw in the pot. And it makes sense today when you start seeing the wave of lawlessness, of people just wanting to make things up on their own, not following any particular, there's no absolute platform in many cases. It's just what you feel, what you think, or what works for you at this time. Lawlessness is coming, and decency and law and order is being moved away. Now again, the world goes in cycles, meaning this is not the first time in history a country, a nation, a government, a culture has undergone this cycle. In fact, a cycle like this comes through every once in a while, and sometimes people recover, sometimes they don't. So in other words, just because we're going through troubled times in our culture doesn't mean we're in the end times of history. It may mean we're in trouble as a nation, but things may continue. So in other words, what we're seeing here today may just be a cycle, but we are facing some times where people want lawlessness. They don't want borders. They don't want anything telling them what to do. They want just freedom. And freedom sometimes is another word for lawlessness. And once lawlessness gets here, the man of lawlessness will arise. And anyway, keep that in mind. Okay, anyway, Paul is being protected by Rome from the mob of Jews and from the governing body of the Jews. He's under protective custody right here. Okay, and this next verse, verse 11, the following night, chapter 23, verse 11, the following night the Lord stood near Paul and said, take courage, or be encouraged. As you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome. And that's a prophecy, that's a promise. That's Jesus saying, be encouraged, I've got it from here, I'm going to get you to Rome. Now, he doesn't tell him, you're going to spend 2 years in Caesarea in prison before you get there. Your life is going to be under attack this entire time. Then on the way to Rome, you're going to be shipwrecked, and you're going to think you're going to die several different occasions. He doesn't tell him all that. He says, you will go to Rome. So it's interesting. You are here, and you've testified here. Now you're going to go to Rome and testify there. Now, I've got the details from here. Just hang on. And it's going to be a rough ride for him. What's interesting, like I said last week, the church somewhere here in Jerusalem, probably over in this quarters over here in the upper class where some of the priests lived, John Mark's house, this is probably where the church is meeting. They also meet on the temple courts, but remember where James had his place and John Mark had his place. They've asked Paul to go up to the Temple Mount to show the Jews that he's not against the law, and they're trying to somehow build some kind of, keep the bridge open for the church that believes in Jesus Christ to keep their ministry open to the Jews. And so they've asked Paul to do some kind of compromise here, and Paul agreed with that. So now the mob has rejected him, the Sanhedrin has rejected him, and at this time you see nothing, the church no longer, they're still there, but they don't come to Paul's rescue. They don't dare stick their heads up and say, well, you know, because once they do that, the Sanhedrin is going to turn on them, the mob's going to turn on them, and so the church just kind of stays where it's at and keeps its ministry going and leaves Paul by himself. And that's why we see Jesus Christ appear to him and says, take courage, you know, I've got this, no one's going to come to help you, I'll get you to Rome, and we'll testify in Rome where God had told him to before. We see God appear, or the Lord appearing to him in Corinth. I've got it written down in the notes. Luke records that when Paul, after he got beaten in Philippi, went to Thessalonica, got chased out of there in Berea, goes to Athens, spends time alone in Athens, then comes into Corinth without any support, without anybody with him. He comes into Corinth, gets a job, and he's been chased all the way through Macedonia, all the way through Greece into Corinth. The Lord appeared to him there also, says, be encouraged. I've got many people in this city. And Paul's going to be in Corinth then for 18 months and begins to build the Corinthian church. So we do see Jesus appearing at different times when Paul is in a situation where every door is closed. Jesus Christ appears and says, no, just stay strong. I've got this. Things are going to start to open up now. And again, that's what happens right here. There's no one else. There's no one there to encourage him. I did refer, and I think I've got it written on your notes there. If you look on page 3, and I ended last week kind of talking about this, 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 16 and 17. When Paul was arrested the second time and is in Rome and standing before Nero, by that time, we're talking not this time that he's going to be going to Rome now in 60 A.D. He'll be there from like 60 to 62 A.D. He'll be in Roman prison, and then he'll be released. But then right around 67 A.D. to 68 is when he's executed, the fall of 67, the spring of 68. Paul's in prison the second time, and that's when he, in Rome, stands before Nero, that's when he writes 2 Timothy. And during this time, he was under house arrest. The Jews are going to come, we're going to see that in the book of Acts. The Jews are going to come and debate with him daily. The church is coming and going. The Philippians send an offering, and Epaphroditus brings an offering to him, and Paul sends the letter to the Philippians. He sends a letter to the Colossians. They send someone, Tychicus and Trophimus, and they go back and forth. So people, Christians are coming and going. The Roman church is coming and going. Jews are coming and going under Paul's house arrest again, because how he's going to be held here, Roman protection. How he's held here, Roman protection. Roman protection, Roman protection, Roman protection while the case is being heard. He's in a rented apartment here, writing letters. People are coming and going. The church is supporting him, waiting for his case. But in 67, when he's arrested the second time in 67 A.D., something has changed. In 64 A.D., Nero began to persecute the church. He began to blame the church for the burning of Rome, which he had done himself, apparently. Again, history's still out figuring that out. But nonetheless, he began to kill Christians, put them in the arena, burn them at the stake, different things like this, dip them in tar, use them to light his torches and stuff. And this is when Peter dies. And so when Paul comes back in 67 A.D., the church in Rome is in hiding. They don't dare stick their heads up. They don't dare go out. Otherwise, they will be killed, like everyone else was being killed. And so in 67 A.D., when Paul is brought into town, in 60 A.D., when he comes to town, they go out to meet him and bring him into town. Welcome to our town, Paul. The church is free to move about. By 67 A.D., he shows up. they don't even look at him. They don't dare because it's a death wish. And that's when he writes this, please. I'm now at on page 3 at the bottom of the notes. Paul's words in 2 Timothy 4, verse 16 through 17, at my first defense, that was his first defense before Nero in 67 A.D., at my first defense, no one came to my support, but everyone deserted me. May it not be held against them. Why is he not holding it against them? Because if they came to my support, it'd be a death wish. It's like suicide. So, well, I agree with Paul. But the Lord stood at my side. I think we should take that seriously. The Lord stood at my side and gave me strength. Obviously, the Lord is always with Paul. The Lord's always with us. But just like in Corinth, when the Lord came and spoke to him, as we see right here, the Lord came to him. So be encouraged. You're going to speak in Rome. I think here we can consider at least that here it is again. The Lord stood by his side, says, you're alone. Everyone, no one can support you, but I'm with you. I'm with you here. And he had the Lord standing by him. I mean, figuratively, in spirit all the time, but maybe more of an actual manifestation, at least in a vision or a dream or something. But anyway, there it says, but the Lord stood by at my side and gave me strength so that through me the message might be fully proclaimed and all the Gentiles might hear it, and I was delivered from the lion's mouth. And that was the case where during his first defense, he stood before Nero, stood before Caesar's court, Caesar's house, all the senators who were hearing. He testified again in Rome at the highest level of Jesus Christ, and he was delivered from the lion's mouth. Now, he then was beheaded, so he wasn't delivered in the sense that then he lived to be 100 years old. He was delivered that he was successful, he finished the race, kept the faith, fought the fight to the very end. He was delivered until he finished his race, and he was rejoicing about that at that point right there. So just nonetheless, I'm just saying, when the Lord appears to Paul, sometimes it's when there's nobody else. Here, the church can't step up and help him because it's going to wipe them out. Here, the church can't step up and help him in 67 AD because they're under extreme persecution. Sometimes Paul is just alone, and the Lord has to stand by his side. Okay, that was chapter 23, verse 11. Following night, the Lord stood near Paul and said, take courage, as you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome. The next morning, this is the 10th day now that he's been in Jerusalem. Now, we've been talking about this for like 3 months, but it's only the 10th day that he's arrived. Remember when he arrived in Jerusalem, they spent the night, and they met with James the next day, you know, a long time ago, we talked about that. It was actually only 10 days ago in the scriptures. The next morning, the Jews formed a conspiracy. Now, who these Jews are, are they the mob? Are they the Sanhedrin? Either case, they are patriots. They are conservative. They are committed to the cause. They do not like Paul because he is against the law, they think, the law of Moses. And this is a warning for me, for all of us, because these, during the days of the Maccabees, if you go back 100 years before this, you go back to, well, 200 years before this. You go back to 165 B.C., you've got the Gentiles, the Greeks, coming in and forcing the Jews to abandon the law. Can't circumcise their kids, can't worship on the temple, burn their scriptures, and they began using the temple for pig sacrifices they're offering to Zeus. The Jews, the Maccabean revolt, rose up against that. They were the patriots. They were the conservatives. They were the ones who said, we're going to steal the law. They were God's people that fought against the Gentiles coming in and wiping out their law. Well, they've continued that mode of thinking. You know what I'm saying? They've continued that style of thinking. And now here comes Paul coming out of Gentile territory saying the gospel's open to all the Gentiles. Let the Gentiles have the same access we have to God. And he appears to be on the side of the solutions of Antiochus Epiphanes. Do you understand what I'm saying? He appears to be the enemy, which 200 years before, 150 years before, was the enemy. And so just what this warning to me is, you can't get stuck. I mean, the truth is the truth. I mean, I'm not saying there's not an absolute, but understand there was a time to reject the influx of Gentiles in Jerusalem because we're holding to the law. We're the people of God. But now the Christ has come, shed his blood. The way of salvation is through Jesus Christ. And he says, go to the Gentiles with this message. It's like, well, no, we're fighting against the Gentiles. He goes, they're dogs. He said, no, no, no. I died for the Gentiles. It's like, and it's like now you've got to have this whole switch in your thinking. Paul's made the switch. Of course, Paul didn't. He was persecuting those who, for a while. But he's made that switch now. And so these people that are going to take this oath, they're wrong. I'm against them. They're fanatics. they're on the wrong side of history. But when you step back and look at them, they're doing exactly what they think is right. And Paul is like a Gentile coming in to destroy the temple, destroy the law. He's a liberal. He's compromising the truth. We've got to hold firm, and God will deliver us. Well, they're on the wrong side of history. I'm not defending him. I'm just saying, be careful, because sometimes you can be right for so many years, and then as time, I'm not talking about truth switching. I'm just talking about God's work switching, as we see from before Christ and after Christ. You understand what I'm saying? I hope you understand. I'm not trying to be wishy-washy, because these people are not wishy-washy. They're going to take an oath here. The next morning, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves with an oath not to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. More than 40 men were involved in this plot. So 40, want to call them conservatives, 40 patriots, 40 Jewish rebels. Now, where they come from, we don't know. But with that oath, at the bottom of the page, page 3, 40 men take an oath, which is the Greek word anathema, and you know what that means, cursed, which is used in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures, to translate the word harim, which you are familiar with, which is used to identify something that is hostile towards God and offensive to God that needs to be burned and consumed and offered to God as a consumed offering. For example, Jericho was harim. It's like, burn it. Don't touch it. Don't take any. That's why, what's his name that took the Babylonian garment and the bar? What's his name? Achan, thank you. He took it. He took the harim and kept part of it. And everything in Jericho was supposed to be burnt. It was supposed to be offered up as a sacrifice to God, burnt and consumed. It was offensive to God. God hated it. It was against God. Consume and burn it. They've taken, it's the same word, just translated from Hebrew into Greek into English. In English, it comes up as oath. They've sworn that Paul is accursed, and they're going to rid the earth of him, or else that curse will come on them. They're going to not eat or drink until they've removed this, like Joshua removed Jericho from the earth, they're going to remove Paul from the earth. They're not going to eat or drink until it is done. These guys sound like, I mean, these guys are serious Jews. They've got scripture, they've got patriotism, they're in favor of God, the law, and Paul is an obstacle, and they're going to, okay, so you understand? 40 men. More than 40 were involved in this plot. They went to the chief priest and elders. So the chief priest would be Ananias, and the elders would be the Sanhedrin, and said, "We have taken a solemn oath not to eat anything until we have killed Paul. Now then, you and the Sanhedrin petition the commander," that's Lycus, "to bring him before you on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about his case. We are ready to kill him before he gets here." So where they go is right here. Remember this right here. The room of the human stone. They go to these guys, say, we got some questions. We kind of blew it yesterday. We got some questions. We got ourselves together. I think we can ask him a few questions and get this case cleared up. So we just want to clarify a few things. If you could have Paul make this 400-yard trip, this quarter of a mile trip from Fort Antonia to the room of the human stone, we'd like to ask him some questions. They tell the Sanhedrin, the chief priest, that's your job. Our job is to be out here, 40 men. They're not going to be like an army. They're going to be like little terrorists, little hiding, you know, sleeper cells, whatever. And on the way here, and Paul's not going to just walk down here. He's going to be brought down with Roman troops escorting him because he's been attacked here. He's been attacked here. He's under Roman protection. So Lycus is going to send his troops, and these 40 men are going to jump Paul, kill him. It's going to involve the death of some Roman soldiers, most likely. Some of these men are willing to die for the cause. Some of these men are going to die. But we will rid the earth of Paul. That's Paul. I mean, does this guy have a strong personality or not? I mean, people either follow him to their death or they take him to his death. I mean, it's not yes or no. It's like you make a commitment to either support Paul or kill him. But anyway, they're going to make that trip. That's what they're asking for. Verse 16, "But when the son of Paul's sister heard of this plot, he went into the barracks and told Paul." Now that's, again, a lot of insight in that verse, a lot of questions. What? All of a sudden, out of nowhere, you've got Paul's sister and her son in Jerusalem. Now, is Paul's sister still in Tarsus and her son has been sent to Jerusalem for training? Maybe. Has the family moved to Jerusalem and that's where the son was born and is growing up? Maybe. Is he just hanging out delivering pizzas and is there at the Sanhedrin delivering a pizza and hears them talking about it? Or is he in training in the Sanhedrin? Or is he a scribe moving around and hears this? Are they believers? I mean, has Paul influenced part of his family and they are now in the church in Jerusalem? I mean, these are all questions that just hang there. We don't know. But somehow we know that Paul's nephew is in Jerusalem. He's close enough to this group right here that he hears about it. And now he goes to Paul. Now again, now where's Paul? He just walks in to Fort Antonia and goes to visit Uncle Paul. Because Uncle Paul's not in prison, chained to wall, being beaten. He's in protective custody. Paul, you've got a visitor. And his nephew comes in. Says, how's things going, Uncle? Real good, nephew. How's the family? How's everything going? Hey, I got to tell you this. And now he tells him, hey, they're going to ask, bring you for more information to a trial. And they're planning to kill you on the way. Okay. But when the son of Paul's sister heard of this plot, he went into the barracks and told Paul. Then Paul called one of the centurions and said, now again, you've got Lychicus, who's in charge of everyone there, about 1,000 men, including 240 cavalry. And then you've got 10 centurions there that are over 100 men. One of the centurions was available, and Paul asked him to come over. Then Paul called one of the centurions and says, take this young man to the commander. That's Lychicus, the guy that's in charge of the whole Fort Antonia. He has something to tell him. Now notice, the centurion listens to Paul, takes his nephew up to the top man here, Lychicus, in Fort Antonia, and he's going to get information. Here it is. So he took him to the commander. The centurion said, Paul the prisoner sent for me and asked me to bring this young man to you because he has something to tell you. So then the centurion leaves. The commander took the young man by the hand, drew him aside, and asked. In other words, come here. No one else is going to hear this information. What is it? I mean, they take Paul serious. I'm lost my place. The commander took him, okay, and asked him, what is it you want to tell me? He says, the Jews have agreed to ask you, that'd be the Jews, the Sanhedrin, the high priest, have agreed to ask you to bring Paul before the Sanhedrin tomorrow on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about him. Don't give in to them because more than 40 of them are waiting in ambush for him. They have taken an oath not to eat or drink until they have killed him. They are ready now, waiting for your consent to their request. Now, Lychicus, you remember we had this written up here. This is 57 AD, 66 AD. We're 9 years away from the Jewish war breaking out. We've already seen the confusion, the chaos here. If Lychicus sends Paul down here, one, he's risking protecting a Roman citizen who they were told ahead of time they want to kill this Roman citizen. That's one thing. But if they're going to attack Paul on this quarter-mile trip, these terrorists, these patriots, these whatever, are going to attack him, that means there's probably going to be some bloodshed on the Roman side. They're going to have to fight to protect. There's 40 of them. So, I mean, you're going to have to knock off 40 of these guys. They're all going to fight to their death. There's probably going to be some Roman bloodshed, or, you know, the soldiers. And you're doing it, like, here's the temple right here. In fact, right here on the wall, there's a place you can go on the Temple Mount wall, the underground, and there's people sitting here worshiping right here, Jews, right there, because it's the closest place they can get to the holy place. When you go down through these tunnels, there's always someone sitting there. And so you're that far away from the Temple Mount. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, this is right here. To have a bunch of fighting right here at the Western Wall is going. It could trip off the Jewish wars in 57 A.D. And so Lychicus is not just, he's interested in Paul. He's interested in protecting his soldiers, but he's also interested in keeping peace because why is he there and not Pilate? Because Pilate kept instigating certain things, and Pilate was moved out and actually, exiled. Because of the chaos that he brought in. And the Romans realized the Jews are a tinderbox and they want this guy here to be level-headed, keep things peaceful, and by merely sending Paul, not only could Paul be killed, Roman soldiers could be killed, this whole Jerusalem could blow up, and Lychicus now no longer is a great leader. He's now the one who let Jerusalem get out of control. So he's obviously going to say, okay, we're not going to do that. Because he's walking him into a war. There's a war going to break out right here tomorrow morning. Well, I think we can handle it. We don't want to handle it. We don't want a war breaking out tomorrow morning, especially if you know it's a trap. So here we go. The commander took the young man at verse 20. He says, the Jews, okay, request. Verse 22, the commander dismissed the young man and cautioned him, obviously. Don't tell anyone that you have reported this to me. We're going to pretend no one knows this. Then he called two of his centurions and ordered them, get ready a detachment of 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at 9 tonight. Tonight, at 9 o'clock, when the sun goes down, you're leaving. Provide mounts for Paul so that he may be taken safely to Governor Felix. Over here in Caesarea, 60 miles away, basically. 60 miles away, that's, we saw last week's notes. You see where the palace was. That's where Felix is at. That's where they have the government. That's the seat of the government. That's where the proconsul, or the governor of Judea, sits. That's where the headquarters, all the administration of Judea, comes out of Caesarea. That's where the Jewish war is going to begin, right here in Caesarea. And so they're going to get him out of Jerusalem and get him up to headquarters. One, Lychicus is going to put him over here. He's Felix's problem now. Now, if you can't protect him, well, I did. I mean, you know, I don't know if that's his intention or not. But it's not going to happen in his city, on his watch. We're getting this guy over here. And we're not going to do a big public announcement. We're going to do it tonight. They're going to expect me to send him to the consul tomorrow morning. When they come, say, can we talk about Paul? Oh, I'm sorry. I sent him to Caesarea last night. Oh. And he's already a day ahead of them before they find out he's gone. So it's kind of just a crazy story. Now, these 270 troops, he's sending him. He figures it out in his head. If there's 40 guys trying to kill Paul, 270 might be adequate to protect him. So he's got, and you can see right there again. And if I flip the notes over there somewhere on the next page, I can't tell you right exactly where it's all at. But that word, going back, get ready, a detachment of 200 soldiers and 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen. So you've got 200 soldiers, 200 spearmen, that's 400, and 70 horsemen. You've got, I said 270, but you've got, I mean, look at this, 470 Roman troops. Two of them are on, or 70 on horses, two of them are on foot, and 200 of them are, and the word is there, it says a spearman, but the word means, let me see if I can find it here in the notes here, 200, yeah, right in the middle of page 4 there, 200 light-armed troops is from the Greek word dekialabos, which means literally holding in the right hand. So you got 200 foot soldiers, 200 holding in the right hand is what it means. Holding what in the right hand? Well, the NIV goes spears, which could be spears. Could be sling stones. These guys are, they've got some kind of a weapon in their right hand, and it's for throwing. It's for this. You got the foot soldiers for hand-to-hand battle. You've got something, 200 guys with something in their right hand, maybe a spear, as the NIV says. Could be a sling stone, meaning they've got the ammunition. And then you've got the cavalry, and Paul is mounted on a horse himself, surrounded by the cavalry, surrounded by the men with something in their right hand, surrounded by the foot soldiers. So these guys are taking, 470 men are taking Paul from Jerusalem to Caesarea. I mean, it's just flat out amazing. So they're going to go down to Felix, Governor Felix. Provided mounts for Paul. He wrote a letter as follows. Now, another word right here, if you don't mind me pointing this out to you, this is kind of interesting. Page 4. Lysias is going to use some, we're going to read this letter and find out a couple things. He's going to kind of cover some things up. But Luke uses the phrase typos, T-Y-P-O-S. You can see it right there. Which he translates, he wrote the following letter. He wrote as follows. It's a technical term which means I have in my hand what he wrote. So Luke is not, the word that he uses is not, he wrote something like this. I heard the letter was something like this. It probably sounded something like this. He says, he wrote this. I have a copy of the email. And he cut and paste the email into the book of Luke. It's a technical term. Now, if that, again, you want to be a critic, that's not really what happened. That's not what he did. He's making it up. That's another whole discussion. The word that Luke uses is, I have a copy of the letter. Here it is in my text. And so you can decide, maybe some people want to argue that the book of Luke or book of Acts is completely made up anyhow. You know, that doesn't work very well. But nonetheless, Luke thinks or wants you to think he's got the letter in his hand. And I agree with Luke. I don't think he's lying. So here it begins. He wrote a letter as follows. Claudius Lysias. Now, there's the first time we find out the commander's name. So far, he's just been called the commander, or he's the tribune. Now we find out his name is Claudius Lysias. Remember, he told Paul, when Paul says, I am a Roman citizen, I was born a Roman citizen, Claudius Lysias says, mine cost a lot of money, which means he probably, during Claudius's reign, that's where Claudius would come from, if you got your freedom during Claudius's reign, you'd call yourself Claudius Lysias. That'd be your name. I was set free. I became a citizen during Claudius's reign. I've been a citizen. My family's been a citizen since the days of Claudius Lysias. Now it's another interesting word. I appreciate you listening to this. It says, to His Excellency, Governor Felix, greetings. Again, that's how Luke or James begins his letters, greetings. You see it earlier in the book of Acts. It's just a typical way of beginning. But I do want to spend a moment on that word, to His Excellency, and then Governor Felix. Governor Felix is stationed right here. He'll be replaced later by Festus. But the word excellency, I've got that written here in your notes here. Let me see if I can show it to you quickly. Page 4. You can see it is, 23, verse 26. Kratistos, it is a word, as a title of respect for a Roman citizen of the aristocratic group. It's those that were the founding citizens, or they've got some connection to the families of the senators. This is the upper level. These are not the blue-collar workers. These are the ruling class. Now, keep that in mind. Obviously, Felix, he's the governor. He's the excellent. He's of the upper class. He's a leader. He's a senator. He's of the founding fathers' families. You got that? Now, keep that in mind, because, again, I don't want to waste your time, but I do want to go to Luke chapter 1, and you know where I'm going. Luke chapter 1, and remember, Luke has written a two-volume set, and he knows he's writing a two-volume set. He addresses that in the beginning of Acts. In my first book, I wrote about the things that Jesus began to do and teach. Now he's going to write book 2, that's Acts. So in Luke's mind, he's got book 1, the gospel, book 2, the works of Acts after the gospel. And notice, both books are addressed to, right here, chapter 1 of Luke, please, verse 1. Luke begins his whole writing by saying, many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Therefore, verse 3 is what we're looking at. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated, that means historically researched, talked to people, talked to eyewitnesses, compared stories, everything from the beginning, it seemed good also for me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent, there's the same exact word, most excellent Theophilus. So the book of Luke is being written to help Theophilus know that without a shadow of a doubt, the things that he has been taught are true. Here are the historical documents. Here's the story of Jesus' life. Here's the story of the church up until Paul's arriving in Rome in 60 AD. And he calls him most excellent Theophilus. So we know that Luke is being written for someone who is of the aristocratic part of Rome. They're in the upper class. A member of the Senate, a member of the family of the Senate, someone from the founding. He is the top, the gospel has reached the top layer of Roman society, and Theophilus is a believer, but Luke is writing to encourage him and let him know these are the historical facts. Again, once again, why would you lie to someone like that? I mean you know it's true, but he's putting something out there. And this guy, Theophilus, he's alive while these events are being recorded. And if Luke is making stuff up, there's eyewitnesses. Luke is not the only one with access to eyewitnesses. Luke is traveling with Paul. There's guys that Theophilus knows, maybe Felix, maybe Festus, Herod Agrippa II. They move in this circle, a Nero's court. And so if Luke is lying, Theophilus is going to know he's got people that he can check with. So if you go back to Acts chapter 1, I again appreciate you listening. Acts chapter 1, verse 1. In my former book, Gospel of Luke, Theophilus, I wrote about all that Jesus began to do and teach until the day that he was taken up to heaven after giving instructions through the Holy Spirit. So now he's writing to Theophilus, book 2. So when he calls him excellent Theophilus, and now in chapter 23 he refers to Felix as most excellent, it's pretty clear Felix, the governor of Judea, is in the same social playing field as the reader, the recipient of the gospel and the book of Acts. I don't want to push it too far. They may know each other. And so here's the letter. I'll read this letter very quickly. We'll pick this up next week. And, okay, tick, tick, tick. Here we go. To His Excellency, Governor Felix, greetings. This is now the words of Lysias from Jerusalem, the commander of Fort Antonia, writing to the guy that he's under, the governor of Syria, the governor of Judea. This man, Paul, was seized by the Jews, and they were about to kill him on the Temple Mount. But I came with my troops and rescued him, for I had learned that he was a Roman citizen. Now, if you go back and remember the story, he went down to arrest him because he thought he was a terrorist and was bringing him up to the barracks. When Paul says, "Can I speak to the crowd?" He goes, aren't you the terrorist? No, he says, "I'm from Tarsus." It's like, and he was speaking Greek to him. It's like, and then he spoke Aramaic to the crowd. And Lysias just stepped back and go, "Oh." And the crowd was listening to him. Then he goes, the crowd started a riot when Paul said something about, "I'm going to go to the Gentiles." They grabbed Paul and started strapping him down to whip and find out, "What did you say?" And Paul says, "Are you going to whip a Roman citizen?" And the centurion says, "You're a Roman citizen?" Lysias comes over and says, "They say you're a Roman citizen. I had to spend a lot of money for my Roman citizen." Paul says, he stretched out, says, "I was born a citizen." And Lysias, "Oh," and all the guys are going to whip him. They say, "Disappeared." And Lysias is like, here, let me get you out of these. Sorry about that. And so he brought him up to the barracks because he thought he's a terrorist, put him on the stretcher to whip him because he thought he was a rebel, and then he finds out he's a Roman citizen. So he was afraid. He had already put Paul in chains. He'd already stretched Paul out to whip him, a Roman citizen. But let's just let that be bygones. Let's just say I came to your rescue from the Jews because I had learned you were a Roman citizen. Now, I learned it about half an hour later, but details are details. Let's just put this in my letter. So I had learned that he is a Roman citizen. I wanted to know why they were accusing him, so I brought him to their Sanhedrin. I found out that the accusations had to do with questions about their law. This is as far as he got. It's something to do with their law. I don't understand it. But there was no charge against him. They didn't really say what it was that deserved death or imprisonment. So see, Paul's not even in prison. They just got to get this case resolved. When I was informed of a plot to be carried out against the man, I sent him to you at once, meaning I'm protecting him, getting him out of Jerusalem and avoiding a civil or a war. I also ordered his accusers to present to you their case against him. So that hasn't happened yet because this is being written out and sent out at 9 o'clock at night. And when they come in the next morning, then he's going to say, "Yeah, you need to go talk to Felix. I'll send you to Felix." So that's going to be taking place eventually. So the soldiers, carrying out their orders, took Paul with them during the night and brought him as far as Antipatris. That is right here. It's about 30 miles. I think it's 27 miles, depending on how you measure it. It's Old Testament Aphek. You can see that in Judges, different places. Renamed by Herod the Great for his father, Antipater, and he called it Antipatris. That's the New Testament term for the Aphek city. That's where they stayed the night. It's a 60-mile trip. Paul's riding a horse, protected by a cavalry, guarded by armed soldiers and foot soldiers. The next day, they left the cavalry to go on with him while they returned to their barracks. So from here, the foot soldiers return the 30 miles or 27 miles back. The foot soldiers continue on. They've gotten through the hill country. They're going to go down through the plain, the coastal plains in. Easy traveling. This is the easy trip right here. This was the mountainous area as they're coming down out of the mountains. Of course, going back up to Jerusalem is going to be more difficult. Return to the barracks. When the cavalry arrived in Caesarea, they delivered the letter to the governor, to Felix, and handed Paul over to him. The governor read the letter and asked that what province he was from, learning that he was from Cilicia, or Tarsus of Cilicia. He said, "I will hear your case when your accusers get here." In other words, I accept your case. You're under our jurisdiction. I'll hear your case. Then he ordered that Paul be kept under guard. Notice, under guard, not locked up, not in prison, not beaten, but protected, Roman protection, in Herod's palace. Now you know where Herod's palace is at. If you look at first page of your notes or second page, you see it's out from last week. It's at the beautiful palace that's built out in the Mediterranean Sea, just right off the coast, but it's surrounded by the Mediterranean Sea. That's where he's being kept under guard in Herod's palace. 5 days later, the high priest Ananias went down to Caesarea with some of the elders and the lawyer named Tertullus. So you're going to, the high priest himself is going to come down 5 days later with his lawyer to present his case against Paul. And again, understand, there's a lot going on here, but the Romans are as interested in protecting Paul as the Jews are interested in killing him. The high priest has an advantage because he's kind of the power, the support of the, he's supporting Rome. But this is not a slam dunk, we're going to lock Paul up and execute him just because the high priest wants to. They want to hear the case. So this is going to stretch out for 2 years. Felix is going to hear it. Festus is going to hear it. Herod Agrippa II is going to hear it. His sister Bernice is going to hear it. As Paul stands, and now he's going to have more and more time, not just to run through the story, they're going to listen to him, and he's going to tell the whole story and testify about Christianity over and over and over again during those 2 years in Caesarea. We'll pick this up next week and see how this goes. It's not going to end well for the Jews. The New Testament doesn't. But God is still working with them, and good things are planned for them. I'll pray, and then you're free to go. I appreciate you taking time to be here. Father, do thank you for the chance to look into your word. We thank you for the things you've recorded. We ask that we would take heed to the written word, to the things your spirit brings to our hearts and reminds us of, the things that your spirit convicts us of, and do the things you've called us to at this time. Again, we thank you for the power you've given to us to mature, to grow in Christ, but also to perform the things you've called us to do in this time in history. In Jesus' name, we thank you. Amen.